This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'd like now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Mark Allison. He's Executive Director of the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance. Max Trujillo joins us. He's Sportsman's Coordinator for the New Mexico Wildlife Federation. And Carol Johnson is here. She's board member of the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance, and she is a community activist. Welcome, everybody, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you.
And we're here to talk about the proposed expansion of the Pecos Wilderness. Now, let's talk for a moment about the Pecos Wilderness and the whole kind of forest ecosystem that is in the area that's under consideration right now. What does that look like, and how is it? I mean, it's obviously artificially divided up because forests are one ecosystem and then the boundaries that we put inside them are another thing. What does it look like?
Well, I think it's first important for folks to know that wilderness, for example, is a protective overlay on existing federal public land. That is different from the national forest, which is open to things like logging, mining, oil and gas leasing, and those kinds of threats. And so some folks don't realize that an area that they really love is not protected. And so some of the areas that we're talking about protecting are roadless, and I know Max and Carol can talk more about that, but that's really an important distinction. They're very rare, and roadless areas are very important for all kinds of reasons. But these are just iconic lands. You know, you can't think about Santa Fe or New Mexico without thinking about the Pecos Wilderness, and it really goes to who we are as a people. And it's about our cultural heritage and protecting our traditions and protecting our watersheds. It's the most visited wilderness in New Mexico. It's the second largest area in New Mexico that's protected as wilderness. So it's really important, and it's just inextricably linked to who we are as a people in New Mexico. And it's really a privilege to have the opportunity to try to work to protect some of these additional areas adjacent to the Pecos Wilderness.
So that's what I'm really trying to ask. You've got the Pecos Wilderness, and then what is around it? What's being considered? And what is that land now? Whose status you want to change?
There's about 120,000 acres surrounding the existing protected Pecos Wilderness.
Now, how big is the existing protected Pecos Wilderness?
It's 223,000 acres.
Okay.
It's the second largest wilderness we have in New Mexico. So these areas right now are Santa Fe National Forest and Carson National Forest.
That surround
the existing Pecos Wilderness. And they're within five different counties. The National Forest is open to lots of different uses. And so that could include things like mining and oil and gas leasing, road building, lumbering, things like that. So these are areas that we think are so rare and so special that they deserve the additional protections that would come with a wilderness designation, a special management area designation. Right now, they're just national forest.
Are these areas that you're considering that are national forest or trying to get considered, are they under threat right now?
Well, they are not under immediate threat, but the potential threat is there. There are places on the Santa Fe National Forest on the Hemis site that have just been opened up to geothermal use. So just it being a national forest does not preclude it from those threats.
Now, how is geothermal use a threat?
Well, the threat itself comes from how they get to the energy that they want to use. There's probably going to be some additional roads that are going to be used by the companies who are leasing these areas to get to that energy. They drill, they infiltrate our grounds. Some of the other threats regarding wildlife is that they fragment our herds. The movement of our animals, our wildlife corridors can be affected, causing the animals to divert their normal routes, their normal movement patterns. So those are some, you know, just some of the threats.
From what I understand, they're going to punch some holes in the ground, and this is the geothermal areas are now major recreation areas over in Jemez Springs.
And I think what we've done, we've learned from hard experience that we don't want to wait until a threat is immediate. We want to try to do something proactive and protect it before there's an imminent threat. If we wait until there's a big proposal from an out-of-state company who wants to do some major commercial development, for example, By that time, it might be too late. You know, the legislative process at the federal level takes a very long time. It's very uncertain. I don't think any of the organizations involved in this broad coalition, at least ours is not, opposed to all energy development, for example, on our national public lands. But that doesn't mean they're appropriate everywhere, and we don't think it's appropriate here because of the sensitive watershed, for example. So those threats are real. As Max was saying, things come up very quickly, and the geothermal development, for example, really would jeopardize the health of this very special area, and we don't want to see that happen here.
I mean, that's something that you think about as, and the energy potential of it is not that high, geothermal, but it is a clean energy source.
Right. And as I say, I mean, wilderness only represents 2% of our total land in New Mexico. So there's millions of acres of other public lands that are appropriate for energy development, for example. We're not opposed to geothermal development, but I think we are opposed to it in this very small area that we're trying to protect. And that geothermal development is just one example. I mean, we're talking about drilling, we're talking about lumbering, we're talking about road building, we're talking about illegal ATV use, you know, motorized, mechanized activities within this roadless area that are just not appropriate.
Now, is oil and gas drilling happening in that area? Are there reserves under that ground?
From what I understand, there has been some proposed areas to be opened up for oil and gas on the Hemis side, the northern Hemis side of the Santa Fe National Forest, to be opened up for oil and gas drilling. So they have found some resources there. There are some parcels up there that have already been looked at from oil companies to lease, and the Forest Service is actually contemplating those leases as we speak.
So that is part of the reason to push the idea of wilderness designation.
Sure. And it's not just oil and gas. There's, you know, they've found mineral deposits up there. They know that there are some resources that can be exploited, and we just want to protect this small area against that.
And actually, the roadless areas were created as roadless areas in order to protect the watersheds and to protect the clean water that's there and connectivity for wildlife.
Now let's talk about those two things, which are related in the way that all ecosystem things are interconnected. When we look at this watershed, what communities is this watershed feeding into?
So the Pecos watershed actually feeds all the communities that surround the Sangre de Cristo mountain range, including Santa Fe, Las Vegas, Pecos, Taos, Peñasco, Dixon, Truchas, Trampas, Española, all of these areas, all of our Native American neighbors along the Rio Grande have tributaries to the Rio Grande coming off of the Pecos wilderness. So the watersheds, or the watershed itself, is the main artery to the well-being of our whole state. Although, you know, on the Pecos side, the Pecos River Basin and the Rio Grande Basin, they are two separate waterways, but it's so important that even sometimes the people in the South take it for granted where their clean water is coming from. And literally, the whole state of New Mexico gets its clean water from these mountains.
Is that right?
And that's why it's so important that we protect this.
So let's talk about what happens when it's designated, when land is designated wilderness, as some of this land already is, and you're trying to annex more land that would be designated as wilderness here in New Mexico. What can and cannot be done on that land? I mean, some of it is already, you say roadless, and that's like an official designation, the term roadless.
Yeah.
What does it mean? Who designates it roadless?
The federal government has designated these areas well before the roadless rule. They passed a roadless rule at the end of the Clinton administration, and they lumped roadless areas in many, many western states, primarily western states, to protect the water and to protect the land from more roads from lumbering.
And so these areas that you're talking about are already roadless?
Yes.
They're roadless, but they're not formally protected through legislation.
So
they're protected as roadless, but as we're seeing more and more, for instance, in the Hemis, the Forest Service or BLM is giving out mining leases or lumbering leases in these roadless areas.
And then in order to fulfill those, they have to build roads.
Yes.
How can they build roads if it's designated roadless?
So the Wilderness Act is the really the gold standard of land conservation. It's the highest level of protection for our national public lands. We should also say, too, that our proposal includes not just wilderness, but also these special management areas, which have a little bit more flexibility in terms of how they're managed. And so what we're trying to do is to safeguard the watersheds, to protect our traditions. Folks who have access there now would continue to. So things like hunting, fishing, backpacking, hiking, birding, you know, all
grazing.
All those things would still be allowed in wilderness and special management areas. Wilderness, you're not allowed to have motorized or mechanized vehicles. So you couldn't have cars, ATVs, motorcycles, things like that. In the special management areas, there's a little bit more flexibility, and we are proposing to designate some of those areas out of respect for some of the current uses. In the southwest and near the Santa Fe area, there's mountain biking trails in some of these areas. So the special management areas would protect these lands from the big kind of commercial development that we've talked about, but would still allow mountain biking, for example.
So the others wouldn't allow mountain biking? I mean, that's not motorized.
It's mechanized, and mountain bikes are not allowed in formal wilderness, according to the 1964 Wilderness Act.
Okay.
In the north, there's one motorized trail in our proposed special management area that would allow continued access for hunters who have been using that, especially during the fall hunt season.
Well, Max Trujillo, you are the sportsman's coordinator for the New Mexico Wildlife Federation, and you're a hunter yourself.
I am. You know, I've hunted in the Pecos many times, and I'll tell you, hunting in a wilderness area, it's a special kind of hunting. There's nothing to compare it to where, you know, in other places where you hunt, you can take your truck or your ATV or, you know, any other means of travel and use it to take your camp and use it to retrieve animals. Many people actually hunt off their ATVs on public land where motorized travel is allowed. But in wilderness, it becomes such a special event in a person's life to be able to go up there and be completely on your own. You take your camp up there, you pack in, pack out. The hunting experience is completely different. The animals, the way they act up in the wilderness is completely different from, you know, anywhere where there's motorized travel allowed.
How do they act?
I'll use a summertime example. If you know, I've gone up several times up to North Fork Lake, which is up above Mora. It's the only place that I've ever seen where you can have a band of bighorn sheep, rams, come right to your camp and interact with you at arm's length.
Oh my goodness.
It's an experience that it's just unrivaled anywhere else in the world. You just don't get that anywhere but in a wilderness area.
Does it, I mean, I'm not a hunter and I respect hunters, but I don't really get it myself. Like, when you have rams doing that, how can you shoot them?
Well, I mean, you don't shoot them like that. And they act very differently in the fall because they're starting to separate themselves from herds, and they're starting to try to attract their mates and things like that. So they don't, in the fall, they act very differently, and they start secluding themselves, and they get in much rougher terrain. So the hunt itself is not going up there and shooting one at, you know, at 3 feet. It's an extreme experience, extreme hunting experience. You have to be very, very strong physically to hunt these animals. You're in their domain. And at the same time, you know, hunters are conservationists. And that's why there's only 4 or 5 permits given for bighorn sheep in the Pecos Wilderness on any given year. And they've scaled back on that when they see that the herd is under distress, not due to hunting, but due to disease or anything else. So there's a conservation aspect to hunting as well. And hunters, real hunters, they acknowledge that conservation aspect. And we know that we need to take care of the resource and make sure that it thrives and make sure that there are animals out there for future generations.
When you hunt in a wilderness area where there are no vehicles, how do you get the animal that you shot out?
Normally in wilderness areas, you do use horses to pack in your camp and to pack out the game that you harvest. So that's normally the way it's done. If you are going to attempt a wilderness hunt, you have to be properly prepared. Pack horses and animals that can assist in packing out what you harvest.
Are there outfitters who specialize in that particular thing?
Absolutely. There are outfitters all around the Sangre de Cristo Mountain that specialize in wilderness hunts.
Now, the world evolved with predators and prey, and wilderness traditionally had wolves and coyotes and other felines and other carnivores that would attack deer. And they would usually take the weakest one, which actually strengthened the herd. What about hunters? It seems like hunters who have guns might attack the most big and magnificent one, which then weakens the herd because that animal is out.
So there's a difference between hunting, trophy hunting, and hunting for subsistence. 90% of the hunters that go out there are using their license to feed their families. Most of us are not trophy hunters. We're not horn hunters. We go out there with intentions of assisting our family. And to me, there's no better protein for a person than the protein we get from wild game. There's no growth hormones in there. There's no antibiotics. We know where they eat. We know where they drink. It's a wholesome way to harvest protein.
But, I mean, the question of which animal in the herd you're taking and whether that strengthens or weakens the herd is still a question.
Okay. To answer that question, if the opportunity presents itself that you take a large animal that would be considered a trophy, okay, it's a reward, I guess, for your efforts. But again, most of us aren't out going for the largest, biggest animal in the herd. A smaller animal, a smaller bull elk, as opposed to a Boone and Crockett caliber elk, is fine for 99% of the hunters out there. We're not out there trying to deplete the gene pool or anything like that. We understand all of that. There's some science to hunting, and we're not out to decimate or annihilate a species. We're actually, conservationists as well. We want to make sure that species has a chance to live on.
And I think one of the most important things to call attention to is that the best thing we can do for wildlife is to protect its habitat. And these roadless areas are critical to the kinds of animals that live in the Pecos. Roads, as Max said, animals behave very differently around roads. Certainly if there's commercial development, that's not good for wildlife. So, what you're seeing is sportsmen's groups, conservation groups, faith-based groups, small businesses, all come to the table together to protect this land that we all in common hold dear. So we're really proud to be working so closely with the sportsmen's groups as we have with other conservation campaigns around the state. And I think, it's been said in the national press that when conservationists and sportsmen's groups ally, like we do here in New Mexico, we're an unstoppable juggernaut. I mean, it represents the vast majority of New Mexicans who care about our cultural traditions and our watersheds.
And we have found a lot of support in the Pueblos. These are spiritual lands for them. They're sacred lands. And I think we have to recognize the fact that it's one of the few places we can go, we human animals, for solitude. And there is less and less of that available. When I have ridden my horse up in the wilderness, I noticed the same thing that Max did with my horse, that the horse and I, the first time I went up there, we crossed a creek, and it was running with a lot of spring melt-off. She stopped. She had never been in a place like that before. The water was totally clear, totally clean. And she would have stood there probably for an hour if I had let her, because she was just drinking in this water.
We're talking about the proposed expansion of the Pecos Wilderness. Now, what does this look like on a political level? Is there a bill that you're supporting? Is there a bill you're trying to get written? What does it look like?
So to protect these areas permanently, like we're trying to do, requires an act of Congress. It requires legislation. And so it's a very long process. And this broad coalition that we've talked about has been working since 2011. And there actually have been previous attempts in other decades. And so what we want to do is we want to generate and demonstrate as much community support as we can. And so that's really about kitchen table talks. It's about going to different associations. It's about talking to different groups. So we're working in these local communities in these five counties, and we do have letters from many of them already, along with businesses and faith-based groups and pueblos and things like that. We don't have a bill yet, but at some point our ultimate goal is to work with our federal delegation to have them draft and introduce legislation to have this area permanently protected.
And so this is how that works. I mean, for every piece of legislation that is designated wilderness, whether it be in New Mexico or in another state, you've got citizens groups and all kinds of groups coming together and saying, we want this, and then it eventually happens. What kind of time frames are you looking at?
Well, this is a very young project right now. Most wilderness designations take years to happen before the legislation is actually presented and heard and voted upon. You know, these designations can take years, literally. We just completed one up in Taos County. The Columbine Hondo Wilderness area was designated last December. That one took, I would imagine, I think it took at least 10 years to get the designation. So it takes a lot of public outreach, a lot of conversations with communities and local governments, local groups that may be even opposed to wilderness at some time, helping people understand the breadth and depth of a wilderness area. It takes a lot of time, and it takes a lot of education, and so that's the stage we're in right now. We're reaching out to the public, to organizations, to local governments, and asking them to support our proposal to expand these inventoried roadless areas into the existing Pecos Wilderness.
Now, help me understand this, because you talked about it a little bit before, but I don't fully understand, and I'm not sure that our listeners do either. If something is officially designated as roadless, but then it's developed for things that need roads, what do? They just violate their own rules and build roads?
Well, the precedence we have is that the Forest Service or the BLM makes a decision, primarily the Forest Service, and proceeds, and then it's up to conservation organizations or legal organizations to sue them.
So in other words, have there been cases in the past where roads have been built in roadless areas, in official roadless areas?
Absolutely. So, you know, we've talked about how the Wilderness Act is the gold standard of land conservation. It's the highest level of protection. It's permanent. It takes an act of Congress. There's a lot of case law. And so when you have a lesser designation, there's a much more discretion. It's generally weaker. It's much more flexible. It can be much more readily amended. And so there are examples of roadless areas. I mean, the whole history of the conservation movement really is in some ways about roads. And there's many examples of formerly roadless areas that have been developed or have had roads developed on them.
So roadless is essentially meaningless.
It isn't. I don't think that it is meaningless. It's a prelude to a higher designation or a higher protection designation.
Or else a prelude to roads.
Not necessarily. I mean, they inventory the forested areas and they see that some areas deserve some kind of protection. In these situations where we're talking about inventoried roadless areas, they are acknowledged and designated as roadless areas. It doesn't stop those areas from being developed at a date down the road because the Forest Service is using these lands for multiple use. Now, what we've done is we have actually done a boots on the ground inventory of these areas, and we have said these areas deserve the highest standard of protection. They deserve to be wilderness. Right now, a inventoried roadless area is managed as wilderness by the Forest Service. There are no roads. So what we've done, and there are roadless areas that are not adjacent to the current Pecos Wilderness. What we've done is we've taken the roadless areas that are adjacent to the wilderness, because those are the most obvious places where we can expand the wilderness into. And we've taken into consideration everybody's interests. Acequia groups have come to us and said, if you designate this area of wilderness, we won't have access to our infrastructure, to our head gates and such. So we've said, okay, the last thing we want to do is impede somebody's access to their infrastructure for their acequias or travel routes or anything like that. So we work with everybody, and we work with the Forest Service, and we make sure that what we're doing is not in violation of anybody's rights or anybody's traditional use or anything like that. But it being a designated roadless area, it doesn't preclude a designated roadless area from being developed at a later date. And that's what we're doing, is we are trying to get those roadless areas incorporated into the wilderness so that roads can't be built there at some point.
Yeah.
It's just a lesser designation. It doesn't offer as strong of protections, and the management plans are much more flexible. They're much more easily influenced by special interests like timber, like mining. And so the Wilderness Act is the gold standard, and there's much more case law about that, and it's a stronger protection. It's a permanent protection. And, you know, we'd all feel pretty silly if tomorrow morning we woke up and there was a proposal for a transmission line through this area, or a mining claim, or a big energy development. And so those things are possible right now, and we just think that this particular area is too special to have that be a possibility.
If people want to find out more information, what should they do, and how can people get involved?
Great question. So we're about ready to launch a new website, and I think it will be www.protectthepecos.com. So that should be up and running very soon. Certainly they can go to the websites of the Wildlife Federation and the Wilderness Alliance for some additional information. They're welcome to call us, email us. We're happy to talk to anybody anytime about our proposal and to hear if they have questions or concerns. This is a very broad-based movement. We rely on citizen conservationists, so anybody who wants to get involved as a volunteer or a supporter would be readily welcomed. We'd love to have their help.
Mark Allison is Executive Director of the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance. Carol Johnson is a board member of that group. And Max Trujillo is Sportsman's Coordinator for the New Mexico Wildlife Federation. I will link to all of those groups on my website, SantaFeRadioCafe.org. Thank you all very much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to RadioCafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.